You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. The Naked Scientist.
22 minutes to 3 o'clock. You best believe that our decision to halt the distribution of the vaccine that we received from AstraZeneca, from the Serum Institute of India, but of course licensed by AstraZeneca, that it's making international headlines. And we got questions earlier for Dr. Chris Smith, our Naked Scientist, around this issue. And he joins us now. And we'll take some of your other questions pertaining to science, anything and everything science related, this Monday, 011-883-0702. And Chris, good afternoon. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm in good shape. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Do you know how excited we were last week that our vaccines had landed? But now it turns out that we did trials, of course. We were looking at trials regarding this variant. And the AstraZeneca vaccine is only 20%. It only provides about 20% protection against a mild version of the current variant. So we're going to have to change tack. So one of our
it's very frustrating, this, isn't it? I was watching the headlines over the weekend and I saw this story come through and I thought, oh no, my heart sank, because I knew, you know, very much the conversation we'd been having previously about the excitement around the rollout, the initiation of the vaccination campaign in South Africa and Southern Africa. And of course, that's now on the back foot while we await the decision. Interesting this, though, isn't it, as to exactly what the thinking is behind this. And some are saying, are the numbers robust enough to justify this course of action? Also, we don't know what the impact on severe disease will be, which is ostensibly why we're trying to vaccinate people in the first place. Get vaccines into people, save lives, is the bottom line here, because the people who need those vaccines are people at most risk. They're generally people who are in otherwise ill health or older. And all that we have at the moment is data showing from a relatively small number of people that that younger people aren't protected from getting mild illness. Now, that's not the same as saying this won't save lives. And I think there are probably going to be some hard questions being put to the people behind these decisions. I mean, it's reasonable when you don't know what's going on to pause, take stock, and then be prepared to change your decision. But I hope that the justification for this course of action is forthcoming, so we can understand why people are taking the decision that they have.
Yes. Well, that sample was 1,750 healthy adults. So you're saying that
average age 31.
Yeah.
And this is the problem, because if you look at the average age of a COVID victim, it's more like 101. No, I mean, I'm being slightly facetious, but the risk rises with age.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people who have died under the age of 60 is very, very small in comparison with the number of people who've died over the age of 60. So therefore, when making policy judgments about the rollouts of vaccines in older people, one must make sure they are represented adequately in trials so that you can actually ask that question. And we haven't seen that data yet. Maybe someone has that data. Maybe there are other elements to this that have yet to be revealed, and more clarity will be forthcoming.
So one of our listeners wanted to know about, what does it mean to say that the vaccine has expired?
Well, any medicine, in fact, any product has a shelf life on it. Bizarrely, a bottle of water has a shelf life on it, despite the fact that water is one of the oldest molecules on the planet, and some of the water washing around in the ocean is going to be here since the day the planet formed 4.57 billion years ago or so. So therefore, you have to have a shelf life on things. It's sort of a way, when you're marketing, it stops people from doing dodgy marketing where they sell you stuff that's ancient. But for safety reasons, we put shelf life dates on products. And in this way, you can say that they have been tested. They're known to be viable. They're known to be safe. They're known to be effective up until this point. We can't lay that same guarantee thereafter. And this means that there's no danger that people will be given an agent that's deactivated or gone off and would give them false reassurance. That's the whole point. And this is there for a very good reason. It's very important that we have these expiry dates on things, because things don't last forever. There are very few things that are completely shelf safe and will have an indefinite shelf life. And this protects people. So it's good. But when it comes to medicines, of course, and the medicines that people need, if that date is expired, then you have to throw the medicines away. And when you've got something which is in very short supply around the world and you're sitting on a million doses of it that will expire if you don't use it, then there's a million other people that will be saying, well, I would quite like to have had that.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the questions that's come in. Hillary's called us also on a related question around vaccines. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Welcome.
Good. So,
yes, what would you like to know? Your question. Go ahead.
What I would like Hello, Chris. Always delighted to hear you and your amazing knowledge and your wonderful way of explaining it too. What my question is I have a daughter of childbearing age. My children are all of childbearing age, but they're all in the either medical or paramedical work, in that there's therapists, and she and her friends have been told that there's a caution about this, I think it's the AstraZeneca vaccine, in that it can affect fertility. Do you have any information about this? They have spoken to their gynecologists, their obstetricians and so on, who are taking it very seriously, but they haven't scoffed it at it. So I don't know if you have any information about where this idea came from and whether it has any validity.
Hilary, thank you for the question. Chris, any insights?
Yeah, hello, Hilary. Thanks very much. The answer is that all products and all medicines might have some kind of impact on your general health. Every medicine has a side effect. We're not familiar with there being any kind of impact on fertility from these particular vaccines. Although, you know, you can't say never a medicine, because you just can't. But the bottom line is that it's gone into millions of people. And at this sort of scale, if there were dramatic impacts on fertility, we would be beginning to know about them, not just from the coronavirus era, but the fact that the AstraZeneca drug is actually based on a vaccine developed over many years that's already seen active service against Ebola in West Africa in the early part of the last decade. And therefore, there's a lot of follow-up data, and a lot of follow-up data on diverse populations around the world. And therefore, we can be reassured that we haven't seen any kind of adverse reaction in that respect reported. What we did report actually on the Naked Scientist last week was a paper that got relatively little attention, I think, because it got eclipsed by a number of other announcements and breaking headlines and things, which meant that people overlooked this paper. It was in the Journal of Reproduction. And researchers in Germany collected samples from men in Iran who had caught coronavirus infection. They also collected samples from men who didn't have coronavirus infection, and they showed that there's quite a big dent in your fertility through having caught coronavirus. These men had lower sperm counts. They had also chemical changes to those body fluids, which we know are associated with higher levels of inflammation, and this persisted for months after the infection. There was some evidence it began to improve towards the end of their study, and admittedly it's one study, but it was a well-controlled study. It was a detailed analysis. Therefore, I'm inclined to believe there's something in it. And therefore, if you were tossing up vaccine, small claim, probably fake news of an impact on your fertility versus a real impact on fertility in men who catch coronavirus, I know which I would choose. And in fact, I have chosen, because I've gone and had a vaccine. So
yes.
Therefore, yeah. So the bottom line is that anything that impacts on your general health can impact on your fertility. And so, therefore, anything that impacts on you severely, like coronavirus, could impact on your fertility too. So that would be, you know, an easy decision to make. Vaccine, don't catch coronavirus, or take your chances. It could impact on your fertility.
Thank you for the question, Hilary. We're taking more of your calls for The Naked Scientist. That's Dr. Chris Smith this afternoon on 011-883-0702. Polo, so you're calling us from Bedford View. Good afternoon.
Hello, Azar. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
I just want to find out, there's a lot of people that I know that believe that potassium permanganate repels snakes like ha-ha-ha. Is that true, or is that just speculation?
That potassium permanganate repels snakes.
I've not come across this. It depends how you use it. Potassium permanganate is just a powder, and it's a dark color when it's just as the crystals. It can be used as an antiseptic, because it destroys things. You can break stuff down and clean stuff with it. But I'm not familiar with its impact on snakes. I would think, because snakes have an excellent sense of smell and taste, if there was a high concentration of it in the environment, they probably would steer clear, because they're going to steer clear of any kind of high concentration of thing they're not familiar with. So I don't know is the answer to this question. If anybody knows better, let me know. But I can't think of an obvious reason why it would repel snakes, first and foremost, other than just they don't like things that that are unfamiliar to them. But you know, if anyone knows whether potassium permanganate will make a snake go away or hiss off, I suppose you could say, do let us know.
Yes. Here's a question while we're still close to the issue of vaccines and the coronavirus. One says, the CDC in the US reported that there are more than 600 variant cases identified in the US. And so what should the strategy be in developing vaccines?
Well, this is spot on. I don't know if the number 600 is accurate anymore. We know of thousands of variants of the coronavirus that have been documented since the outbreak first began over a year ago. We know that, of course, multiple countries have disclosed more exciting exotic variants where various changes or mutations have come together as a constellation of changes in the virus, and that has led to enhanced transmission. South Africa is one example, in the UK, another example, in Brazil. Another example, all of this happening independently. America also now has a number of documented mutations and changes in this way. So what this is telling us is that the virus is not a static thing. It's a moving target. What makes it move is evolution. It's evolving and optimizing its ability to spread as it goes through humans. And where you've got areas where there's high levels of infection, you've got lots of rolling of the genetic dice, giving the virus many opportunities to introduce these changes genetically and select out the ones that work really very well. Because the virus is on the move, we have to make sure our vaccines are also equally agile. And in some respects they are, because they can be relatively easily updated to represent changes that the virus has made in the vaccine. But the headache isn't making the vaccine or the intellectual property that goes around actually how you do this in the first place. It's the scalability, how you turn that updated vaccine into a drug in a syringe and then into the arms of millions, if not billions of people around the world. And this is why this is proving such a headache, because if you have got a variant that emerges, because people are highly mobile and the virus hides, you know, half of people who've got it have no symptoms whatsoever, it flies around under the radar and it can be all over the place before you've even detected that you've got this happening. And so we're going to really struggle to contain it for this particular reason, which is why vaccines help us a bit, but they're not the only answer to this solution. We're going to need a combination of public health measures and also drugs. And there was quite an interesting study, hasn't again had that much attention yet, but a study came out of Israel a week or so ago. In fact, the clinical trial data came out on Friday, where they have made a drug or repurposed a drug that was originally a cancer remedy. And this is I think it's CD24 immune molecule based therapy, but they claim that in a small group of people with severe to moderate disease, they gave them this drug and it helped to temper the response of the immune system in the lungs of these patients. And most of them who were treated went home within 3 to 5 days from hospital, which was a marked turnaround compared to how long you would expect those people to be in hospital. So people are saying, is this a game changer? You know, there's been lots of game changers in the coronavirus pandemic, hasn't there? But it might well therefore be that we have a way of vaccinating people to attenuate or mitigate against very severe disease. But we also, in parallel to that, we have to search out drugs that mean that if people do catch it, we can treat them.
Okay. Let's get back to the lines. Leone, you're calling us from Emerentia. Hi, Leone.
Hi, dear. I'm turning my radio down. I wanted to ask the doctor, I was reading about how bats, certainly in China, house dozens and dozens, I think it was 90 or something, different viruses, including Ebola and whatnot. And I presume that bats here in Australia and all over the world are the same. And, of course, we don't eat them here as they do in China. But, you know, is there any way that the bats in other countries are also causing problems?
Dune, thank you. Your thoughts, Chris?
The answer is yes, they do. And we think actually there are thousands of coronaviruses, and that's just the coronaviruses out there, many of them lurking in the bat population. Really good example of this, Ebola, you already stated that, and where bats snuggle up to humans, the viruses in them can jump. Another very good example, Nipah virus, initially documented in Malaysia and Singapore in the late 90s, where it caused an outbreak. We've subsequently documented more outbreaks of Nipah virus in parts of Bangladesh, for example. And when people have looked, they found that this is where humans end up interacting too closely with these bats. In the case of the Bangladesh outbreaks, what was happening is people were doing palm juice tapping, and the bats like the date palm juice as well. And so the bats were flying down in the nighttime and drinking the juice that the people were trying to tap out of the trees. and the bat saliva has got Nipah virus in it, and it was getting into the juice, and the people were then drinking it, and they were catching it. So it's a history repeats itself all over the place, where you get human overpopulation and high population density and encroachment on the natural world, bringing animals with their viruses into close proximity to humans, which is a big giant wood pile just waiting for someone to set light to it. You are therefore increasing the likelihood that things harbored by wild animals can jump the species barrier and get into us. And then, of course, because we're a completely susceptible population, very well networked, very well connected, all living in very high density, it then takes off. And that's exactly what happened with this coronavirus. And it's what happened with Ebola about 8 years ago.
Let's get back to the lines. In Kempton Park is Mzamo with his question. Hi, Mzamo.
Hi, Alan, Chris. How are you?
We're good. Welcome.
I'm good. I just wanted to find out something about the viruses. How does the virus know it needs to change, and to change to what form so that it can keep its existence?
Right. Thank you for that. The intelligence in a virus.
The answer is it doesn't know, because a virus is not alive in the sense that it doesn't think. It's a tiny particle, 1/10,000th of a millimeter across each individual virus particle of coronavirus, and it is nothing more than an infectious bag of genes. And those genes contain the genetic instructions to get into a cell, hijack the cell, turn it into a virus factory, and make that cell spew out hundreds to thousands more virus particles, which can then go on and infect other cells in your body, but critically also infect other cells in someone else's body when you cough, sneeze, or in some other way dispense that virus back out into the environment. So how does the virus know, in inverted commas, to evolve to become better at doing that? It's a numbers game. It is all about selection and evolution. When a virus grows in your body, from time to time, it makes genetic spelling mistakes. This is just a random thing that happens by accident. So you end up with a virus where its genetic code has changed a bit. Now, most of the time when this happens, it will completely screw up the virus. It's like putting the wrong wheel on your car. The car's not going to drive very well. It will probably go off the road and get stuck in the mud. So your car's history. But say someone puts into the car accidentally massive great wheels with much better tread that work really well, suddenly your car is going to have a lot more ability to hug the road, accelerate very quickly, and swerve around everyone else on the road and go very fast. And that's exactly what happens. Occasionally a virus will emerge which has got the right combination of genetic spelling mistakes that it doesn't disable the virus, it weaponizes the virus, it gives it an additional advantage. And when you get a virus like that, once it spreads much better. And very quickly, because all its progeny have got that ability, they spread much better. And the progeny of those progeny spread much better. And you've got something which now is taking over the population. And so you see these waves of virus emerge, where a virus with a new characteristic that's better comes along and takes over as the dominant strain until something displaces that by being even better. And it's an evolutionary arms race. Meanwhile, the human race is fighting back by changing our behavior. Our immune system responds when it sees these things. And as a result, you get this kind of continuous arms race going on, where eventually they settle into a sort of equilibrium where the virus is about as optimal as it can get. And we're fighting back as well as we can. And you reach a sort of stable point where they cease to make each other more or less ill, as it were.
More virus questions. Lena in Highlands North. Hi.
Hi, Chris. I just want to ask you, I heard on a podcast by a doctor who is involved in one of the hospitals here with the COVID ward. And he said that because of what you call it, the Johnson vaccine, he said that it actually hasn't got antibodies, and that perhaps because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you only need one vaccine, not two.
Okay.
And he said, but maybe with the Johnson & Johnson, you might actually need a second vaccine. So I just want to find out, because I believe that AstraZeneca isn't quite suitable yet,
yes,
or has got a problem, and that maybe we might roll after Johnson.
I've got to push
Johnson.
You on the question, Lena. I'm out of time.
Yeah, I just want to know whether the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has got antibodies or
okay.
not. because for us, okay. I'm just curious. Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Lena. Your thoughts,
Thanks for
Chris,
the question.
Quickly?
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a modified virus that delivers the outer coat of the coronavirus message and makes you make an immune response to it. As such, it's got the same constraints as any other vaccine in that if the virus changes, you have to change your vaccine to keep pace. The benefit of Johnson & Johnson's product is that you need at the moment one dose with that in order to provoke that immune response. But other vaccines at the moment, they're using two. What we don't know, though, is whether you can use that Johnson & Johnson vaccine more than once, because if you have it and you make an immune response against the thing that's being used to carry the virus message into the body, which we think will happen, it might mean that then you can't go back and use it again and again and again because you've started to defend yourself against the thing that's bringing in the message in the first place. So that remains to be seen.
Right. There were a few other questions on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but you know this is a running issue whenever we bring you on, Chris, so there'll be ample opportunities to raise these questions again. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Take care.